This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
BBC Sounds. Hello, Lucy White here from BBC Scotland's Podlitico. We'll let you get back to Scotland Outdoors in just a moment. But first, I want to tell you about our podcast. We're a team of political journalists who like to unpick what's actually happening at the Scottish Parliament and Westminster. We look at all these political decisions and what they mean for you and me, and we try not to take ourselves too seriously. We have a new episode every Thursday at 6pm. Subscribe to Podlitical on BBC Sounds. Now back to Scotland Outdoors.
The Scotland Outdoors podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thanks very much for downloading this podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. Winter is definitely approaching, you can feel it, and we're doing our level best to embrace it. My companion today in this podcast is Ewan McElraith, and fair to say that you probably prefer summer.
I love the summer, Marty. I love wearing shorts, but there's something about winter that is just so comforting. There's a handful of leaves left on the trees, but it is a glorious early winter's day. There's not a cloud in the sky. You can feel a bit of heat in the sun. You can see the squirrels playing in the trees, and the birds are so much more obvious. So there's a lot to love about this.
Well, a few weeks ago on our live programme Out of Doors, you might have heard a chat we had with a lady called Siri Melland in Norway. Now, Siri was telling us about the concept across there of friluftsliv, which literally translates as free air life. Now, here she is.
In Norway, friluftsliv is regarded as a main ingredient of our Norwegian culture. It's about connecting with nature and enjoy life, even in the winter. We have a saying in Norway, it's not bad clothing. You need good clothing. You need to keep dry and warm. So I keep saying wool, wool, wool. It's the only thing that works. You need to have wool closest to your skin. Yeah.
Somebody got in touch during the live programme and said, yeah, that's fine, but it's impossible to get hold of 100% Scottish wool, which I must confess kind of took me back. I thought, that can't be right, surely. So we thought we'd investigate a bit further.
Yeah, as ever, we didn't have to try terribly hard because our well-informed listeners are just a delight of knowledge. And they came to the rescue, which is how we heard about our guest today.
Yeah, Louise Scully is a knitter and hosts a podcast called Woolwork. Now, she sent us a fairly comprehensive email about Scottish wool and its production, so we thought we'd ask her to share her knowledge with the group. Hello, Louise.
Hello there. Hi.
You're originally from Shetland, which is effectively the Scottish capital of wool. Did you grow up knitting?
I did, yeah. I am from the island of Bressa. I learned to knit as an infant, really. My mum was a machine knitter, and her mum was a machine knitter. And whilst I'm not a machine knitter, we always had needles and yarn. Maybe it was a way to keep us quiet. I'm not sure. We were very lucky in Shetland because up until relatively recently, knitting was taught in school in primary and secondary as a way to connect the next generation with the craft. I learned at home, I carried it on through primary school, but then I got to become a teenager and I kind of left it by the wayside, and it was quite some time later that it became all of a bit of a revelation to me again.
We were given advice from Surrey and Norway that having really decent woolies is an intrinsic part of embracing winter. I mean, we go along with that. What's your winter wardrobe like?
I would say that woolies are an intrinsic part of my everyday wardrobe, no matter what the season, because wool is very adaptable. It can adapt to regulate temperature, and it's very good for layering. There's that period of just after the autumn equinox when nature is all engoldening and you can feel that edge of winter coming in, and I look for the heavier woolens and I get the woolly socks out, and there's definitely that need to bundle up. I'm a knitter year round, so I have to wear my goods year round as well.
There is an absolute conscious delight putting on the first thick jumper of the year. It's a bit like a hug.
The cardigan that I'm wearing now, which of course nobody can see, but it's a Cheviot. I always like saying that because I don't think a lot of people know that Cheviot make nice wool for knitting with, but it's incredible. It's hardy. It could probably stand up on its own, and it will probably outlive many winters. So it's like a hug.
You mentioned the sheep. Let's look at Shetland sheep. Why are they so prized for their wool?
They're really, really spectacular. They're one of our primitive breeds, very similar to the Neolithic animals. They're part of the Northern European short-tailed breed, which also includes Hebridean, Soay, Borrowry, North Ronaldsey, these great Scottish breeds. And they are wee sheep that have absolutely evolved to live on the rockiest outcrops and the peripheries of Scotland, certainly. So that's number one for me. They're just absolutely fantastically hardy. But when it comes to their fleece, they offer this veritable smorgasbord of colours. There are somewhere between 9 and 11 natural colours in Shetland sheep, which is an absolutely phenomenal thing. You don't find that in any other breed. And then there are different textures within one fleece. Traditionally, the neck wool of a sheep is seen as the softest and finest, and that is what is used in creating these fantastic heirloom wedding ring shawls that you may see, as well as making the finest, most delicate things. It can make the most hardiest and well-wearing things like Fair Isle. What is also wonderful is that Shetland wool from Shetland is only marketed in Shetland. It doesn't come to the mainland and go through the British Wool Marketing Board. So Shetlanders really have taken ownership of every stage of that. And that means that when the wool is bought in Shetland, it means a bigger return for the farmers. So it's fantastic.
What about the environment the sheep are raised in? I was out walking the dog and there was kind of a real mixed bag of sheep next to me. There was a couple of Texels, a couple of mules, a couple of blackface, all out there and out. You know, it was driving rain this morning. How much does the environment impact on the quality of the wool?
The wool is grown to, in many cases, deflect dirt, sand, rain, so that the softer wool fibres on the sheep's back and closer to the sheep's skin are kind of protected. But in terms of what impact the weather has and the environment has on fleece, it's the same as growing any other crop. If you get a good growing season, you get a good fleece. If you get a really, really quite wet and dreary growing season where the sheep's back is absolutely sodden, you get breaks in the fleece and you get weaker fleece. And that, I believe, then leads to a lower price when that is graded and sorted. I like to think of wool as any other crop that we grow.
I remember being in one, it was a wool merchant's in Lerwick. And I can't remember the gentleman's name, but I mean, it was a fantastic building. It was like a barn, you know, quite posh from outside. And I mean, just rainbows of colours, you know, actually in the shop part. But when you went through to the warehouse, it was just big piles of fleeces, different colours of fleeces and things like that. And the chap had a good, strong handshake, but probably the softest hands I've ever come across in my life. He was handling the wool all the time.
That man would have been Oliver Henry.
That's the man, yeah.
Tenderly called Ooey Ollie, Ooh is the Shetland word for wool, who is an incredible man. The skill that he has, I mean, he's been doing that job, working with wool all of his life. And it is amazing when you go into that wool shed and you can see just how many different colours there are and different textures. I mean, I am absolutely 100% categorically biased. Shetland wool is absolutely phenomenal. It really is.
I think we probably would have guessed that, truth to be told. There are particular styles of knitting depending on your location. One of the most famous, obviously, being Fair Isle, the island which sits between Shetland and Orkney. Can you just, I mean, for folk that don't know it, describe the Fair Isle style? What's the history behind it?
The history of the Fair Isle style is really the history of stranded colourwork knitting across the world, because that kind of style of knitting didn't originate in Fair Isle, although it's become incredibly popular and incredibly famous because of those islands. But actually, the earliest stranded colourwork knitting designs come from ancient Egypt, which is it's absolutely unbelievable. You can see pieces in museums that have been recovered. The style in Fair Isle, though, is absolutely phenomenal. There are hundreds and thousands of different patterns, different motifs. These can be all over in a sweater, so all over the whole body, or quite often, which is still very popular, you see yokes, so a colourful collar design. It really became popular commercially in the 1920s when Edward, the Prince of Wales, was seen wearing Shetland Fair Isle, and that became a really big thing. That was the first big push, which has just continued to ebb through the 50s, certainly the 80s. There was a massive, massive boom, and it's something that you can see is tied to Shetland heritage. Shetland wool, you can use other wool, but Shetland wool really is the best yarn to use for Fair Isle. And as you said, the colours that are available are absolutely phenomenal. The teaching of Fair Isle in schools and knitting in schools stopped in about 2010. But in the last few years, there's been a massive upsurge of children learning to knit Fair Isle. And it's an incredibly wonderful thing to see the new generations who are picking up these skills.
What about North Ronaldsay? I mean, everybody knows about, you know, they're famous for their seaweed eating and they're really prized for the taste of the mutton. But is the wool any good? Because these are hardy beasts.
The wool is incredible. And North Ronaldsays are very like those early ancestors, those primitive breeds. They have retained the double fleece, a double coating. So on the outside, the fleece is very hairy. It traps all the sand because, as you say, they've been forced, exiled since 1832 to live on the shore to protect the precious land from the sheep. And so they've kept that coat, which keeps out the sea and the sand. And when you shear the sheep, you get this really, really soft undercoat. And again, you know, you can kind of see in this swatch here that it's quite hairy on the outside. But my goodness, that is soft, and that will, again, it will make items that will last you years. The North Ronaldsays are just an incredible breed. In the 1970s, the Rare Breed Survival Trust actually got involved there and decided to take some of the flock off North Ronaldsay because they saw the danger of North Sea oil, that an oil spill could have on that very rare flock. So there are flocks now in the mainland, but they all derive from those seaweed-eating sheep on North Ronaldsay. And in the mid-90s, they established a mill there. So they're actually creating North Ronaldsay yarn from North Ronaldsay sheep in North Ronaldsay, which is a wonderful story.
It's probably worthwhile pointing out, when you say that the sheep were exiled way back when, you know, basically there is a wall that runs all the way around the perimeter of the island, and the only land that the sheep have got access to is the shoreline, essentially. You know, they've been booted off the good land.
Yeah, I think it was when the kelp industry died away and they needed to use the land, and the land on some of these islands is just not that great soil-wise, and with all the sheep, they were a real danger to that land. So yeah, I often do wonder what they thought might have been the effect, that they'd just send the sheep out there to see what would happen. But they are a real success story, and they are one of our rare breeds. So, you know, when you see that in yarn form, when you see that in knitted goods, buying that, knitting with that really helps to keep that breed going. I think there are between 500 and 900 registered breeding yows in the North Ronaldsay flock now. So, you know, they're at risk, but the more we can do in our making and our purchasing is going to help that.
How do you get from a dot of wool on the back of a sheep to something that you can actually work with?
There's quite a few different processes wool goes through. And obviously it has to come off the sheep. It's a health matter, well-being matter. It's got to come off. There are essentially two processes that wool can go through. It can go to a woolen mill or it can go to a worsted mill. Woolen mill means that the wool comes in, at every stage of the process it's sorted and graded for fineness and for handle, all of the things that we might want out of a yarn. If we want a dense springy yarn or a long luxurious yarn, we've got to think of the best way to spin it. When we go through the woolen spinning process, it goes through a carder, which is a big machine that basically rips and tears the wool all out of alignment. You'll have seen pictures of hand spinners with carder paddles that they do on their laps, and this is the mechanical version of that. For the benefit of those at home, this is a little tuft of wool that has been carded. It's All of the fibres are out of alignment. It's, you can see through it. It's.
Can I just say, Louise, for the first time ever in this podcast, I'm wishing this was television, you know, because you're holding various samples up to your camera on your computer, and it's beautiful stuff, but...
Being an audio podcaster myself, I do know how difficult it is to get over how things look and feel for the benefit of people listening at home. But essentially, carding is a process where the wool is all torn up. And as it goes through this carding machine, it creates a web of fibre that is then spun into yarn. And the resulting yarn is really airy because all of that jumbled up fibre traps air. So it makes a really airy, lofty yarn. This is the kind of yarn, woolen spun yarn, that is absolutely fantastic for fair isle because all of those airy fibres gel really well together when you're using different colours. Also gives you a kind of a heathered effect because you can see the halo of the yarn over the fabric. So this is what you would call a woolly yarn. If you are spinning worsted spun, it doesn't go through that carding process, it goes through a combing process so that all of the fibres are aligned. And keeping the fibres in alignment when you spin that yarn, it is a really strong yarn, it is a really drapey yarn, it's a really long-wearing yarn, and that is the kind of yarn that originally hand-spun Shetland shawls would have been made from. It's also the kind of spinning we would do if we want to make socks or long-lasting items like that. It's also really fantastic if your wool has a luster, say like the long wool, English long wools are very lustrous, because that kind of spinning, it retains that kind of reflective nature. So from there, it's just about what you want to make with the yarn.
You're painting a wonderful picture, and I'm seeing your different types of yarns and wools as you're holding up there, and I'm seeing the cardigan you're wearing. It's all lovely, but speaking to the farmers around me, and I think it's probably the same in Shetland, is they struggle to sell the wool. Quite often it costs them more to shear it. The wool check used to be a main part of people's incomes. Now many folks say it's worthless.
Well, people used to pay their rent with their wool clip. Yeah, you're right. And as the years have gone, particularly this year with COVID, the return for wool has been really minimal. I'm hearing things like 30 pence per fleece. That is,
wow.
Yeah, and that is nothing when you think about the labour that has gone into taking that fleece off and to get it transported to the mill or the wool board or wherever you're taking it. I hear that people say from the field they want to burn it or bury it because that is the only way that they can get any use out of it because it costs them money to take it off the sheep's back and get it to the wool board. This is something that I try and do through my podcast and through the work that I do, is just to say, let's have bigger discussions across the board from the people like me who want to buy it and knit with it, who see a value in single breed British and Scottish wool, and try and have a conversation where we can show those wool growers exactly where the value is. And, you know, in the last maybe 5 or 10 years or so, there is that consciousness growing. There is that interest from wool growers saying, like, well, let's try and make a yarn ourselves. Let's try and go down this way, or joining up with others who do have the wherewithal to start a business, because obviously farming is a business on its own. When you start to think about selling yarn, you're adding a lot more to your plate. So we're seeing a lot more people who are from their own kitchen tables getting up and speaking to their local wool growers, their local farmers, and saying, what are you doing with this? Can I buy this? Can I give you a better price for it? And there are some incredible businesses in Scotland who are doing just that, and they are creating really special blends of yarn that you just don't see being made commercially. So what you get from that is something that is a really special, almost one of a kind, because obviously a sheep's fleece is different year on year. US Mill have been a community interest group for a few years now, and they wanted to bring back the skills in wool and put value back into the local wool. So what I've got here is a very stripy yarn, which is Cheviot and Zwartbliz, which is a Dutch breed. You don't get this in a ball of yarn that you might buy from your haberdashery shop. I'm holding up just a cowl here that's made in a textured stitch using that yarn, which knits up into an almost amazing gradient. So it's about having more of those conversations, joining up people who are doing these great things with wool, and then trying to find a way to tell that story, because these small wool businesses don't have access to the same marketing that big companies do, or it might be their second job next to, you know, looking after the sheep. So it's not all about buying yarn, of which I have quite a lot, but you know, it's about finding these farms on Instagram, or finding where these wee sellers are and just sharing it, and really trying to get people to share those stories more, because those stories are the thing that people are interested in. They're the reason that people want to buy that wool.
Can you hold that cowl up again so I can see it? See, that to me looks like, say, a January or a February afternoon, looking out to sea. It's cloudy, it's rainy, you know, and it's just the sun is just about to go down, and you end up with that sort of almost like a silver band on the horizon between a dark sea and a dark sky. And it's got that gradation to it too. It's beautiful.
It's incredible. And, you know, they're doing other great things. You know, they've got one that looks a bit like, has a silver birch effect when it's knitted up because of how they manage to blend the wool together. And again, it's using wool from local breeds. Cheviot is a wool that for a lot of years it went into carpets. It still does. Or it goes into bus seats or plane seats and things like that. But it also makes a cracking wool to knit with. And so it's finding the businesses like that that are doing things with this wool that, as you say, some people find worthless. Some people say it's a byproduct, it has to come off, we need to get rid of it. But there are people out there who are doing astonishing things with it.
People talk about, you know, food miles. I've never heard anybody talking about clothing miles.
There is a movement out there. You know, people are interested in that as well. And I mean, again, you can trace it. It's easily traceable to from someone's field, from someone's kitchen table, to my knitting. And I really do think that when I can wear something like this or this cowl, when I wear something that I've knitted in one of these yarns, it's a flag to fly. It's a flag to fly for that breed, for the skills involved in looking after that sheep, growing that wool, the skills involved in milling and creating yarn, maybe dyeing as well, and then, you know, what I choose to make with it. It's a really powerful statement for local wool.
It takes real talent, real skill, to take those unique yarns and make them into something special. But is there the skill set out there?
It's, again, it's getting better in terms of production. The UK as a whole needs more. From even scouring facilities, we don't have a lot of that in the UK. We don't have a lot of the beginning process to get the fleece cleaned before it can be spun. So when you talk about wool miles, you know, wool might go from Shetland down to Yorkshire to be cleaned and spun before it comes back. But in terms of the skill in creating yarn, it's there, but we need more of it. We always need more of it. We need more people to come up through the ranks. One of the things that I would love to do if I didn't have to work, I would be learning to be a wool grader and sorter. That is a job that takes about 10 years experience to really know parts of a fleece, different breeds. You know, it's incredible skill that's involved in terms of knitting. Knitting has never really gone away. We hear about comebacks all the time, but that skill is there. And knitters, speaking from my experience, you're always looking for the next thing to learn. It's a constant learning experience. And when you have this ongoing interest all the time in knitting and learning different skills, and, oh, I've done lace now, I'll learn fair isle, or I've learned fair isle now, I've learned cables. It's an incredible journey.
My father's side of the family are from Fraserburgh, and they were fisher. The women of the family would knit guernseys for the men, you know, and they always had the unique patterns. So if the men were lost at sea, they could be identified. You know, the bodies, theoretically, however long months later, could be identified by the patterns of the knits. You're making a face. Why are you making a face?
I don't want to debunk that, but...
But you're going to.
We have to remember that fishing was mobile. And people went all over, especially in the, you know, the herring. People went from Shetland all the way down to England, maybe further afield. So those patterns were travelling all the time. So whilst it might be true that certain knitters had their designs and their patterns, it's not always the case that you could identify a sadly departed fisherman by the pattern on his jersey. Also, that sometimes they just were never recovered again.
No, well, that's very true. I like the fact that you take a product which has life, unlike a synthetic product. You know, wool has life. Someone you love is making something for you. There's a connection there. I mean, we said that originally the first big jumper of winter is a hug. There is a linkage there all the time.
And that's the thing that I particularly love, because I think as a knitter, you're always putting yourself into what you knit. And that's one of the reasons why I love knitting. I find it very therapeutic, very grounding. If I need to think over something, I'll sit down and knit for a while, or I'll spin. I've got a spinning wheel in the background here. It's a very, very grounding thing, but what you can put into that, you're right. When you make something for somebody, you're not just making them a physical item. You're putting all that thought and love into it, and it really is an incredibly meaningful piece of knitwear, whatever it is that you make. But on the topic of Guernseys, there's a fantastic initiative right now with the Scottish Fisheries Museum, who are looking to create a national Guernsey collection, and there's lots of events going to be happening in the next year. They're going to create a Guernsey yarn. They're going to go around, albeit virtually probably for a good while, around where the herring went to find different patterns and find different jumpers, and they're digitising these patterns. So again, that has come up and is a real interest for the knitters now, that they want to create Guernseys. So it's an incredible thing.
I know lots of people that knit for babies and toddlers, but by the time they get to teenagers, they don't want to wear wool.
Yeah, and I was one of those teenagers. You know, I enjoyed it as a child, and I didn't really enjoy it wearing wool or knitting when I was younger. And when I came to it, it was a bit of a revelation that I was like, how could I have forsaken this for so long? You know, it was so I don't know how you make it popular, but I think the incredible work that's going on in terms of, say, for example, Shetland Wool Week, which has been going for 11 years now, and again was virtual this year, but that casts an eye, a global eye, on an area, its wool, its traditions. There are always things like Kirsty Allsop and people on the TV who every now and again turn their eye to knitting and say this is a new thing and it's cool and things like that. For us that have been doing it, we just try and, you know, be enthusiastic. And I have to say that my friends will testify that I have managed to shove balls of wool and needles into their hands, and now they're doing it. So I think just being sort of cheerfully evangelical about it and trying to get over what an incredible thing it can be to make something and finish something and the whole process of it.
Your podcast, Woolwork, you've got listeners all over the world. I mean, how broad a reach have you actually got?
It's quite broad. It started in such of a whim kind of way that I never used to look to see who was listening from where. But a few years ago, I did a talk at Shetland Wool Week about the Shetland Hap, which is a shawl, type of shawl. And we had done a knit-along.
A knit-along? Yeah.
So a knit-along is something that happens where you are all making the same thing, whether it be a certain sweater or a type of design, where people can participate via either listening or watching a podcast. There are lots of video podcasts, or taking part via social media. So this one we did on the Shetland Hap was a really interesting one. And when I went to get a bit of feedback for this talk that I was doing, I asked where people had been knitting from, and there was somebody from Bermuda.
Sitting on the beach, knitting a Shetland hap. Yeah.
I think that was a big eye-opener for me to show how far it travelled and how many people were really interested in hearing about the kind of thing that I was interested in. But really, it started because I wanted to learn more about the wool in the UK, and I decided one day, on a train from Aberdeen to York, looking at all these sheep going, oh, I wonder what are their wools like to knit with? And I just decided that I was going to try for a year to learn all there was about British wool. And then I quickly realised that was never going to be near long enough, because I'm still learning now, and that this is 8 or 9 years later. I always thought, if one other person hears this and thinks, oh, I'm going to look into local wool as well, then I'd succeeded. When you start to look into provenance and you realise how much is out there in terms of how much wool there is in the UK, I mean, there anywhere between 60 and 90 breeds, if you, depending on where you get your information and if you include crosses and things. That is more than any country. And when you look at the size of our isles, it's an absolutely amazing thing to have that diversity of breeds and of the textures and characteristics of those fleece in, and what they become like in yarn. So actually, wool tourism is a kind of a thing now. And your correspondent, the last episode who talked about buying wool in Norway, you know, that Norway is a big wool destination as well. Iceland, Scandinavia, you know, it's incredible that people want to go places and as part of their holiday want to take a bit of that wool away with them as well.
Something like merino wool from New Zealand has become very fashionable in recent years, particularly amongst folk like us, you know, outdoor enthusiasts. Fine, it's from New Zealand. I mean, does Scottish wool have the same potential?
Merino wool is incredible and it is amongst the finest fibre out there. Fibre is measured in microns and the lower the micron, the finer the wool. Merino has the finest diameter and it's very hard to find Scottish wool that parallels that. In British wool we have Blueface Leicester, which is one of the English long wools, which it can get as fine as merino. But there is a really, really good luck story in this, which is the Beaumont sheep, which I don't know if you've heard of before, but the Beaumont sheep were actually designed by the Macaulay Institute. They wanted to try and find a sheep that could provide wool as soft as merino, but could live in the UK because merinos are not best suited to our climate. So the Beaumont is a mixture of merino and Shetland, and it creates this wool which goes into Finisterre, who create a lot of wool base layers and wool products.
I've got one last question for you. We were talking earlier about the fact that, you know, every handmade garment has something of the creator invested in it. Of all the thousands of items that you've probably made in your life, what was the one item that you had most of you invested in? What was it?
Oh, that's really hard, actually. I mean, I think making a Shetland hat was an incredible thing for me because the Shetland hat has many guises. A hat can essentially be any kind of square or triangular shawl, from the most heirloom wedding ring shawls.
That can pass through a wedding ring, yeah.
Yeah, to the humble hap, which I call the humble hap, which was essentially a triangle or a square with a very plain centre and a little bit of feather and fan stitch, or old shale it's called, just a very simple lace edging. And that was the one that I wanted to learn to knit because that was the one that Shetland women made for themselves. So they had to keep the good wool for the fine haps and they had to use what was left to make the items for them to keep them warm, and they did whatever they could do to make them look a bit pretty, so they might dye them themselves or they might try and add in different colours. And when I think how important the, you know, the hap has become for knitters, it's one of those things that knitters like to make. They like to tick off their knit list, and you know, there have been some books written about Shetland haps in the last few years, and when I think of how that's come up from this humble thing to being something that every knitter in the world wants to make, I felt I felt extremely proud to make a humble Shetland hat, and it's something that I do trot. I should have brought it out. It's massive, but it's something that I trot out every winter. But the other thing that I feel especially proud in having doing was actually, although I am a Shetlander, I don't know if I should admit this, I'm not very good at Fair Isle knitting. I know, draw your breath. But a few years ago, there was a pattern that came out that I thought, I'm going to try. I really need to try. And so, as I was saying earlier about how the Fair Isle tradition has evolved and, you know, it's moved away. Well, they still incorporate all these wonderful traditional motifs, but designers also look to other things now to incorporate in their knitting. And this is a hat which has crofthooses on it. And this was a design by a Shetland designer called Ella Gordon, who had incorporated crofthooses into her Fair Isle. And again, it was an absolute air punch moment for me because I made it and it actually looks all right. It's a bit small, but I'll wear it because I'm proud of it. And again, it's another little badge of achievement for me. And it's made in Shetland wool, of course. So those are the wee moments for me that make me very glad that I'm a knitter and very proud to be a knitter.
Louise, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. And thank you very much for taking the time to speak to us.
Oh, thank you for listening to me talk about wool.
You can find Louise's podcast on all the usual platforms. Just look for Wool Work. If you'd like to get in touch with us and tell us where you listen to this podcast, we do like hearing from you. Denise got in touch from Washington State, USA, and made us dead jealous with her idyllic cabin where she knits while listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get in touch, you can email us at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. From myself, Mark Stephen, Ewan McElraith, producer Helen Needham, and of course the lovely Louise Scully. Thank you very much for listening.